New World Witchery is possible thanks to the generous support of our sponsors. We'd like to take a moment to recognize our producer-level Patreon supporters. Abby, Akia Branvansianak, Aromages Botanica, Athena Beth, Baga Marsh,
Braga, Benjamin, Brianna,
Carol, Catherine,
Christopher, Conjured Cardea, Daniel,
Dave, Don, Donna, Aaron,
Griffin, Heather, Jen Rue of Rue and Hyssop, Jess, Jody,
John, Jonathan at the Modern Southern Polytheist, Christopher, Matthew Venus, Minimiel,
Montine of Book of My Shadows, Nikki, Peyton, Scarlet Pirate, Stacy,
Stephanie, Ralph from Hola's Haven Podcast, Violet, and Wisdom Queen.
To show your support and keep the show going, please consider visiting patreon.com/newworldwitchery, pledging $1 a month or whatever you can. And as always, thanks to all of our listeners. Are you looking for magic? Maybe magic that lives right where you do?
If so, join us aboard our broomsticks and ride with us from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from the Yukon to the Yucatan, and find magic that's right outside your front door or just off of Route 66.
Whether you're in the Windy City or the Crescent City, the city that never sleeps, or the city of brotherly love, we've got enchantment for you.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane, and this is New World Witchery.
This time we're discussing American Brujeria with author J. Allen Cross. I remember being caught speaking Spanish at recess. That was good for 3 licks on the knuckles with a sharp ruler. I remember being sent to the corner of the classroom for talking back to the Anglo teacher when all I was trying to do was tell her how to pronounce my name. If you want to be American, speak American. If you don't like it, go back to Mexico where you belong. I want you to speak English. Vaya buen trabajo tienes que saber hablar el inglés bien. Que vale todo a tu educación si todavía habla inglés con tu accent, my mother would say, mortified that I spoke English like a Mexican. At Pan American University, I and all Chicano students were required to take 2 speech classes. Their purpose? To get rid of our accents. En boca cerrada no entran moscas. Flies don't enter a closed mouth is a saying I kept hearing when I was a child. Attacks on one's form of expression with the intent to censor are a violation of the First Amendment. El anglo con cara de inocente nos arrancó la lengua. Wild tongues can't be tamed. They can only be cut out. This passage from Gloria Anzaldúa's How to Tame a Wild Tongue discusses a number of aspects of the author's Mexican-American identity. She chronicles the differences in culture and gender expectations, and importantly, also addresses the issue of language, the wild tongue of the title. At one point in the essay, she chronicles the different tongues she uses. She says she's learned to speak standard English, working class and slang English, standard Spanish, standard Mexican Spanish, North Mexican Spanish dialect, Chicano Spanish, from Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California, all having regional variations, Tex-Mex, and Pachuco, also called Caló. Existing between 2 cultures, like Anzaldúa describes, is incredibly difficult. The words and worlds can cross over, bleed into each other, change things around without rhyme or reason sometimes. Yet there's also a beauty in being in between. Author J. Allen Cross describes his own situation as one of those who existed in between. Growing up, I faced a lot of discrimination from both the white kids and other Latinx students. You see, I look Mexican, and my family is clearly Mexican given our café con leche skin and our dark hair and eyes. I would be profiled and called terrible words by the white kids, yet I was also looked down upon by those quote-unquote, real Mexicans, who were actually from Mexico or whose parents had been immigrants. I didn't speak Spanish then, and even now I struggle with the language. Every time I come across a word in Spanish I don't know, English inevitably pops out of my mouth, filling the gaps. There's a metaphor there that I would desperately like to ignore, but it's no use. Spanglish. Just like my blood, my speech encompasses the indigenous and the colonizer alike. Cross shows how his culture is very much a liminal space. And as anyone who has listened to this show for long knows, liminal spaces are very, very magical. So it should be no surprise that a powerful sort of magic emerges from Cross's experience. In his book American Brujeria, he chronicles his own history with the folk magic of his heritage, but specifically looks at how its continued growth and existence in the United States has left it with new contours and shapes, something different than the Brujeria of Mexico. It's its own tradition, full of magic and wonder, and occasionally a little terror and heartbreak, but that's true of all great enchantment. I sat down with Cross to discuss his origin story, his experiences with folk magic, and his new book. All right. Our guest this time around is J. Allen Cross, the author of American Brujeria, a book talking all about the experience of Latinx folk magic in North America, specifically one interesting take on that. And I'm going to be talking all about that with him tonight. So I wanted to say welcome. Thank you so much for being here. Glad to have you at New World Witchery.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, let's start with your, kind of the superhero origin story of you. I know you're a huge fan of a lot of different folk magical practices and traditions, and that you've done some study in many of them, right? But where does all this start for you? Where was that moment when you realized you were witchy, and then how did that sort of grow for you?
Yeah, so I feel like this is sort of a trendy thing that everyone is saying nowadays, but for me, this actually started from the very beginning. It was very clear to me very early on in childhood that not only was there something very different about me, but also specifically that it was that I was a witch and witchcraft was the thing. That was very clear to me early on exactly what it was. And I don't know how I had that vocabulary for it at such a young age. But anytime I would see witches in the media or any sort of portrayals of witches, I felt very connected to that. And I was like, that is what I am. Even at a very young age. I grew up Catholic and I did get in trouble on several occasions for carrying around like a big, heavy, like children's Bible and calling it my spell book. that was a problem. And I was really young because I remember I couldn't spell at all. And while it was during the summer and all my friends and people I knew were, putting up flyers to, mow people's lawns for money or like, doing lemonade stands or whatever, I was asking my father how to spell exorcism because that's what I wanted to provide to my community at that point. So this was something that was very normal for me when I was younger. And so I always knew pretty much the entire time that that's what was going on. And then furthermore, it was something that was also practiced in my household. I grew up Catholic, the family around was Catholic as well. However, we were definitely different in the way that my mom would read tarot cards at the dinner table for her friends. I remember there being blue candles full of black glass that were used for banishing one of my mom's terrible bosses, all kinds of things growing up. And then, of course, I have my grandmother was a visionary. She used to hear the voice of God. She used to go to temple. She was devoutly Mormon, surprisingly. She used to go to temple and pray, and then she would receive visions. And that's how she gave most of my family their Native American names, was mm-hmm. through these visions after she would go to temple and pray.
Mm-hmm. And she was Native American as well, wasn't she?
Yes.
I think that's interesting because I do know I have several friends who are Mormon and kind of in that Mormon
sort of religious structure. And it is interesting, visions and dreams and things like that are still very much treated as a part of the sacred experience there. And, you know, you're right, there's kind of a magical edge to that, isn't there? So your main interest is folk magic, obviously. You've got, multiple kind of angles of folk magic that have sort of intersected in your life. But your book is largely focusing on the kind of Latinx practice known as brujería, which I think usually we sort of, anglicize and translate that as witchcraft. But, is that exactly what it is? Is there a difference between brujería and what we might think of as kind of like English or Western European witchcraft? How are they alike and how are they different?
They are very different, and it's a weird conundrum for us, because when we translate things, we can only translate them so much or get the words as close as possible to the words that we know. And so in a technical sense, yes, I think brujería would translate as witchcraft. But unfortunately, people hear that and then they run with it without realizing, the history and the context and the actual practice itself is very, very different from, kind of these European styles of how we know witchcraft to be. They are similar in the way that we all kind of sit at the same table. We're there to kind of, make things happen. We're here to kind of bend reality, change things in our favor wherever we can. But that's kind of the end of the road as far as it's concerned. Our practices are very different. And while we all kind of share certain commonalities, one of the unfortunate things that's happening right now is that people are also translating Wicca as brujería. Mm. And then people who are doing Wicca think that they're brujas, or people go, oh, well, brujería is just the same thing as Wicca, therefore I can practice it. And that's not really how this works. People are really into sanitizing things these days and making them more palatable and more comfortable. So they like to change everything about it until it kind of looks like something that they would like to participate in. So a lot of the time these days, people are talking about how brujas are just misunderstood and they're healers and they're here to make the world better and all this stuff. And that's not how Mexican countryside brujería works. Mexican, like real traditional Mexican brujería, is very dark. It's very forceful, and it tends to be very manipulative as well. And while the information to heal is there, it's often seen as a very negative practice. And people like to sort of blame that on the church, but that's not really where it's coming from. These are people's direct experiences with brujas. And so there's brujería, people don't realize that it's not used as the wide umbrella that we use witchcraft as. It's talking about a very specific practice that is not very friendly. In Mexico, we have several other types of magic, things like hechicería, which translates sort of to sorcery, which is where you see more of like the burning candles to saints and things like that, which has very little to do with actual brujería. That's very different. And then we also have curanderismo, which is kind of the Mexican folk healing practice and cleansing. And that's very Catholic based, as well as a lot of indigenous knowledge is brought into it. So it's not quite the umbrella that we like to use witchcraft as these days. And it's definitely not misunderstood in Mexico. And that was one of the funny things about my book, is that you hear American people from outside of the Latinx community, and they talk about like, oh yeah, Santa Muerte, she's a loving mother and nothing but bunny cuddles. And you hear them be like, yeah, brujería is just misunderstood healing practices. But you actually talk to real Mexicans like from Mexico, and they're like, no, none of that is correct.
Right. Right. She's just as likely to demand that you crawl a mile on your hands and knees, as to...
Yeah.
To get the blessings, right? So, exactly. Yeah. So, and I'm glad that you brought up hechicería and curanderismo, just because I think a lot of people wind up lumping them together and thinking they're all the same thing. And I love that you're saying, no, that there are different spheres being worked here. Even if there's some overlap, they're certainly not the same. And one of the things that you kind of bring up in this book, and you mentioned this idea of kind of people looking at Mexican brujería from the outside, but your book is about American brujería, right? Which is a little different than maybe the brujeria we might find in places like Oaxaca or Mexico City, right? So what is it about American brujeria that's sort of setting it apart from these more immediately Mexican forms of the practice?
Absolutely. So when I went to write this book, I wasn't sure exactly what to write about at first. And a lot of people kept telling me, oh, you need to write a book on brujeria. And I'm like, I don't know, like, actual traditional brujeria. That's not something that I practice. And so I struggled for a while, you know, like, should I go down to Mexico for like 5 years and, you know, learn from somebody or, you know, in order to write a book, you know, what exactly is going on here? But then I began looking around at my immediate community, those around me who are Mexican American, which is a very different demographic than Mexican people or people from Mexico. Those of us who have been here for several generations, who are still, you know, Latinx, but are highly American, we're in between a lot. And therefore, we also have our own very specific way of working this magic. A lot of us who are Mexican American, we flash back to that scene in Selena where Abraham's on the bus and he's going, you know, we had to be more Mexicans than the Mexicans and more American than the Americans in order to fit in anywhere because we're stuck in the middle, right? Because we're Americanized enough that Mexican people don't, you know, claim us as their own completely. You know, we're not quote unquote real Mexicans. But at the same time, we're Mexican enough to not fit in with mainstream white America either. Mm. So we're kind of in an island unto ourselves here. And post-immigration from any culture will have a huge impact on the style of magic that is being worked because your landscape is different. You have access to different tools and you lose access to some of the ones that you were used to relying upon, as well as your problems are different. So your magic is going to change, especially when it comes to folk magic. When people immigrate from Mexico into the United States, they have to carry with them as much of that mystical knowledge as they can, and then kind of put it into a giant pile and pick out of it what they need to survive at that point, which forces a big shift in how this work looks. So for instance, in Mexico, if you needed a cleansing, you would go to a curandero or a curandera. However, in the United States, curanderas and curanderos, they do exist here in the United States, but they're very hard to find, especially legitimate ones. And so we as Mexican people who have immigrated to the United States needed to sort of take that work into our own hands. We didn't have curanderas around anymore. We didn't have, you know, brujas around anymore. We had to do this work ourselves. So that's why we see a lot of shifts. Like, you know, we don't necessarily go to a curandera, but we do know somebody's mom or their tía that we can go to who can do this work. So the work shifts when we move, you know, whether it's immigration or going to new space. And that's kind of what I wanted to highlight in this book, the fact that in the United States, this practice is very different among the descendants of Mexican immigrants. And that's why I wanted to call it American brujeria. And the reason why I chose to continue to use the word brujeria is because among Latinx youth right now who are practicing this style of work, you know, lighting saints candles and things like that and asking for things and praying the rosary, you ask them, you know, what is this called? And they'll say, oh, it's called brujeria. And it's kind of a joke, but a lot of people don't realize that it's a joke because, you know, it's like that witchcraft is that magical stuff. And so it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek sort of thing. The way I tend to describe it is growing up Native American, there's this thing that happens where we as Native Americans will either refer to ourselves or our friends as Indians. And that's a very racially kind of charged term. And among us, it's sort of a joke that's funny, but when you come at it from the outside and call us Indians, it takes on a very different sort of vibe. And that's sort of the same way that brujeria works, right? It's kind of a joke that we're all practicing, you know, oh, brujeria, you know, but it's very different from what we see in Mexico, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I love that you brought up this sort of energized embracing of the term brujeria, even if it's kind of tongue in cheek as it's happening, because I think there's a lot of that that we're seeing where people are kind of grabbing onto that and really running with it. You know, this is, there's a whole, you know, hashtag Bruja, trend on, you know, Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, on TikTok. So this is a, you know, it's something a lot of people have felt very comfortable, you know, grabbing onto. Which is interesting. And I think that you're right. I think there's a tongue-in-cheek aspect of it. But then there's also the sense of, like, some people are like, and also I am doing, you know, magical work. So sure, right. Let's call it Brujeria. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you talk about, you know, the practice of this. But one of the things that I think is really interesting in your book is very early on, you sort of raise the idea of, you know, who can practice this kind of magic, right? Like what is this going to do? And I think you even have a section that starts off with like saying like, can non-Mexicans use this magic? And the very first thing you say is like, yes, absolutely. Right. And I think that's interesting. So you definitely make space for people to come into this from the outside and understand it and practice it, but you're also being very, very cautious about, you know, not, you know, feeding into cultural appropriation. So can you talk a little bit about how somebody who is interested in American Brujeria, but not from that Mexican American background, would work with elements of this tradition? And then how do you navigate sharing this tradition in sort of these tricky spaces of where appropriation has happened?
Yeah, it's interesting because so much of this work is Catholicism. And Catholicism itself is definitely not a closed practice. In fact, Catholics would love it if everybody was Catholic and did these things. So it's hard to say that, you know, people can't do things like, you know, light a novena to saints or, you know, pray the rosary or things like that. You know, these are very open practices. And when I was first writing this book, I knew that, you know, going with a larger publisher and, you know, wanting to actually have book sales, that I would have to at some point say that this is something that, you know, people can do, that this is open to everyone. But I wanted to put a big however after that, because a lot of times books that are put out on, you know, magic from minority cultures just kind of say, yes, this is open to everybody. Everybody can do this. Come on in. And then they don't give any guidelines or anything for, you know, respecting this culture. And something that's very important for me with this book is understanding that you can't really practice a folk magic if you don't understand the people that it came from. And so part of writing this book, I wanted to give people kind of a window into our culture, how this works. You know, where does this power come from? You know, it comes from, you know, God, and it comes from our family, and it comes from tradition. And that's something that I kind of talk about in the book as well. When it comes to using this magic from outside of the culture, I always try and kind of think about when and how people might want to use it. And so I see occasionally online people being like, you know, when they really need to use a magic, not using it because of fear of cultural appropriation. So say somebody read my book and there's a section on limpias to how to like take off a curse or something, right? And one of their friends comes in and they're like, oh my God, I've been cursed. You know, something, you know, really bad is happening. You know, it has hit the fan. I don't want someone to go, well, I learned how to do this in this Mexican folk magic book, but I won't help you because it's somebody else's culture. I don't want people to run into that, right? If someone is in need and they need to pull out, you know, a limpia on somebody, I want them to feel like they need to do it and that that's okay to utilize this magic when they need to. At the same time, though, I don't want this to accidentally encourage people to read my book, begin calling themselves curanderos and charging hella money for limpias, right? There's a big difference between that. So when I introduce this idea that like, yes, you know, people from outside of this culture are welcome to be in here, I also give guidelines about what does that mean to be respectful of this magic. And that includes, you know, being respectful of the people that it comes from. And also my three main guidelines that I post in the book, for avoiding cultural appropriation and sensitivity are basically ask yourself three questions. The first one is, does it make you money? You know, if the answer is yes, then you may want to rethink how you're handling this work. The second one is, does it take up space? You know, like there's it's one thing to kind of, you know, light some candles to Guadalupe and pray the rosary in the privacy of your own home. It's another thing entirely to, you know, start up a brujeria business that's putting out the local abuela, you know, out of business as well, or creating competition for other marginalized communities. That's very hard. And the third one is, does it erase culture? And this is one that a lot of times people don't realize that they're doing, but it kind of goes back to what we were talking earlier about trying to edit or revise stories and traditions in order to make them fit into something that you would like to do. So it's something we're seeing a lot these days with Santa Muerte. People are like, oh yeah, she's, you know, patron of the marginalized. And in Mexico, the marginalized is very different than what the marginalized is in the United States. I've heard people say that, you know, in the United States, people from outside of the culture have been saying things like, oh, empowered women are marginalized and therefore fall under the patronage of Santa Muerte. Meanwhile, in Mexico, what they meant by the marginalized was people who God, the saints, and the other Holy Spirits had completely turned their back on because they had to resort to a life of crime, like drug running, mugging, murdering, in order to feed their families and make sure that they survived. So again, we have to remember the people that this comes from in order to have the context of the work. So that's very important to me. And that's something I really want to talk about in the book, that if you are going to come from outside of the community, to understand these things and to be a guest and a follower in it, if you are going to participate in it.
And sort of inherent in all three of those is listening to the community and interacting with that community, I think, too. Because I think there's a lot of people who, and like you're saying, you don't want people to pick up your book, you know, do three of the spells and then start calling them calling themselves a brujo or a bruja, right? But similarly, you don't want them to pick up the book, you know, read it through thoroughly and start practicing and then never have contact at all with any Latinx people.
Right, like that would exactly.
I mean, I don't know how it's possible in contemporary America, but I'm sure people find ways. You know, there's plenty of racist people in America. But, you know, I think that's such an interesting thing is that you're kind of building that into this sort of saying, look, are you taking space away from, you know, Mexicans or Mexican-American people kind of in these marketplaces. And the only way you're going to know that is if you're actually looking for and listening to that community. I think that's really, really smart of you. That's really interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of kind of how you've laid this out. And I like the guidelines. I think that's really interesting to see there. So one thing that's kind of come up a couple times, you talked about, you know, carrying around your Bible as your spell book, right? And we've talked about this folk Catholicism, and you and I have talked before about, you know, I come from a more Polish and Irish folk Catholic background, but I can see some similarities between some of what we're doing, right? And La Iglesia, the church, you have a whole section on that here in your book because it's so important. Mm-hmm. I'd like you to kind of talk about that, because I think there are a lot of people who get really resistant to the idea of, you know, is there Christianity touching my witchcraft, right? You know, and they get very right. turned off by that. But you see this less as, you know, mixing Brussels sprouts and chocolate, and much more as mixing, you know, peanut butter and chocolate, right? Like, this is two great tastes that go great together. So can you talk Absolutely. About how those things all fit together for you?
Yeah, so this was something that I began to notice with my local community. I live very near a Catholic monastery. And being in that space and the fact that the surrounding area, because we're so rural, is full of a huge Mexican population that frequents this place. And so you go there and you find their work all over. There's a big stone shrine to Mary. And you'll find all these novena candles there. When I'm hanging out there one time, and this is in the book, I loved this experience where I was just kind of walking through the space and I watched this Mexican woman kind of pull her car off to the side, and she gets out with this big bag full of novena candles from the store. And I watch her cross herself as she gets out of the car and start praying all the way up to the shrine, and then she gets out all of her candles and she's still praying while she puts them all out. And so this work in holy spaces is so powerful, because instead of kind of, you know, doing this at home where we're asking God to come to us, we are going to God. You know, we're putting in that legwork. We're going up closer to kind of the places where we feel that the divine are residing, and putting our magic directly in this house, whether it's the church or the surrounding area. Even inside the church, there's a lot of places where people are putting novena candles and burning them inside the church with their prayers. And I think that's a very powerful way at going about this magic. And, you know, there's all this stuff about, you know, you can't necessarily say that in order to practice magic, people have to be Catholic. But to be honest, you really have to sort of believe. Otherwise, what are we even doing here? You know, if you don't believe in God or don't think that the saint exists or can help you, then why are you burning a candle to it? There's nothing behind it for you then. And if you do believe in God, if you do believe in the saints, you know, if you do believe that if you pray to Jesus over your novena candle, that something will happen, then I have news for you. You might accidentally be Christian. And that's very scary for people. And so I know that there's going to be kind of a big grouping of people that kind of gets my book and then goes, oh, well, I'm going to do this work, but I'm also going to reject the Christian portions of it. In which case I say, then find a completely different path of magic, because as soon as you do that, you are no longer practicing Mexican folk magic, right? Because this is intertwined with it so deeply that you can't just reject Christianity and continue to do it. They're so glued together that you can't separate them. And so I welcome people to find other forms of magic. If they have big issues with Christianity and just can't bring themselves to do it, that's absolutely fine. There are many, many paths of magic that do not have anything to do with Christianity, and those are very open to you. But if you are ready to kind of traverse that landscape of where magic and Christianity intersect, that really interesting crossroads, then I think you might be surprised at what you find.
Mm-hmm. And there's also, it's, you know, it's not, you're not necessarily saying people have to be Orthodox Christians in the sort of sense of like, you know, governed by every rule that the church puts out or anything like that, right? Like they're not, they don't need to be paying attention to every papal encyclical, right? This is something where there is some space. On your podcast, I know you both talk about the idea of sort of queering the witchcraft that people are doing and sort of working in these liminal spaces. And there's some liminal space even within that Christian practice. So in some cases, you may be working with folk saints, right? Non-official, mm-hmm. non-canonical saints, or even the devil. Like the devil can enter into the practice mm-hmm. from time to time as well. And that's all part of the experience. Am I summarizing that correctly? Do you feel like am I in the right zone with that?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. We call it kind of folk Catholicism, which is Catholicism with a pagan twist to it.
Right. Yeah. And again, it's liminality, which is, I know that's a big thing for you as well, is this, you know, find the spaces that are in between. And even as you said, you know, American brujería is this, it's incredibly liminal because, you know, you're both and, right? You're working from sort of both perspectives of being Mexican and being American, and yet being neither at the same time. So it's this amazingly liminal experience. So yeah, I love that you kind of get into that. Now, one of the other kind of angles that we have to kind of think about, I think, with witchcraft, a lot of witchcraft is very locally rooted, right? It's locally rooted either in terms of the traditions and the practices or in terms of the ingredients. And I know where you are, and I'm not sure if you're comfortable with me saying exactly where you are, although it is in your Instagram handle, so maybe you're fine with it. But how do you balance kind of the locality of it? For you, when I know that you're not kind of close to some of the sources for some of the ingredients for, you know, Mexican brujería, right? So how do you work that side of it?
Absolutely. And as a folk practitioner, I do think it's really important to take your location into account. And the way I always think of it is, if someone, you know, who was, you know, a hardcore Mexican folk magic practitioner was to move to my area, you know, what would they be okay with, you know, is sort of the idea. And all of folk magic has to revolve around what you have on hand. You know, our ancestors weren't going online and ordering plants from foreign countries and things like that. You know, they had to make do with what was around them. And I think that's a very important practice and something that I do bring into this work, at least into my personal work. So say we're talking about the section on limpias, where we're talking about bariras, doing sweeps with herbs and plants. A lot of the plants that we use traditionally in Mexico are ones that we would find in the United States. This is things like tulsi basil, rosemary, rue, things like that. These are all things that are very accessible to us here. But then there are also other ones that we don't necessarily have. There's, you know, espanto muerto. There is a plant called alamo that I don't think grows around here. There is I believe it's called a California red pepper tree. These things are things that we don't necessarily find up in the Pacific Northwest. You know, I'm in Oregon. And so I look around myself and I see other possibilities, but the practice is still the same. We just have to understand the mechanics of it and know that what we are bringing into it is still going to fit within that. So for instance, if I'm going to do a sweep with somebody, it's not uncommon for me to use evergreen branches, like pine branches, because they are very cleansing. They're very powerful in that sense. But that's not traditional Mexican, you know, at all, at least not one that I have found. That's kind of a very Pacific Northwest idea to use something like a pine bough. But still it works because we understand the mechanics behind it. We understand the use of it. And if my ancestors had been living in the Pacific Northwest, they probably would have started doing the same thing because it's important to reach for whatever is around you. And that's also why we find differences between, you know, people who practice this work in Texas, where they're so much closer to Mexico. That American brujeria will look very different than somebody who's in New Jersey. And that's kind of the interesting idea of the fact that this is a living, breathing, evolving form of folk magic. The book isn't about this ancient practice. It's about what's happening right now, things that we are practicing. And so in the United States, we've had to make some choices, some substitutions in order to continue the magic forward with what we have around us, which is important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, and I think that you make a really good point there that, you know, even within this specific sort of branch of the tradition, there's going to be other sub branches, right? There's going to be other directions people are going to go. That is all going to change with their locality, right? And I love your point about if you can understand the mechanics and then understand how your local environment works, you can make those two things work together. Because I really see that in what you're writing here. And I feel that in kind of the folk magic that I talk to people about. So, you know, what was it like putting this book together? How did you wind up doing your research for this? And what was kind of your, you know, if you want people to walk away from this book with one thing, what's the big thing that you want them to take away from it?
So as far as kind of the research and putting it together was concerned, is I at first was just going to flat out write it from my experience, because this is something I have been practicing for quite some time. Me, like many people who are Mexican American, this type of work sort of just finds its way into their hands and they end up sort of starting to practice what I call American brujeria without even realizing it. And that had happened to me as well. And so I had already been sort of practicing this for several years when I got the idea to write the book. And then, however, I realized that I couldn't just write this book from my perspective and from what I knew, because it's so much bigger than me and my experience. You know, there's people all around me who are experiencing this from varying level of, you know, quote, Mexicanness, you know, how soon their family had immigrated, you know, how recently that had happened, you know, all these different factors play a role in people's work. So I began just interviewing everybody I knew who was of Mexican descent that lived in the United States, from anyone who was first generation to people who actually immigrated themselves to the United States, to people like me whose families had been here 3-4 generations, all kinds of stuff, and getting their stories and how they did it in their family. Because everyone has their own sort of twist on it. Everyone has their own way of kind of going about it. You know, no two people will do Olympia the same way. But again, you know, the mechanics are the same underneath it. The idea is still the same. So it was a lot of me sitting in, you know, Mexican restaurants or on the phone with people that I knew, getting their take on it and learning about the things that they did in their family, which was very interesting to get a look at. As far as what I hope this brings kind of to the community and how I hope it sort of impacts thing. Number one, I'm hoping that this will blaze a trail for other Latinx authors. At this point, I don't know if I have another book of Mexican folk magic in me. I'm at this point considering just leaving that subject here and letting other people come forth and do that. And I'm hoping that my book creates an opening or a doorway for more Mexican and other Latinx voices to come forth and get published and to talk about their own magic from their own perspective and their own cultures, which is good. And I also hope that this clears up a lot of misunderstandings about words like bruja and brujo and brujería. And I hope that it just kind of brings some truth into kind of the American occult sphere. And at the same time, I hope it helps people who are Mexican American, who might have lost, you know, contact with their heritage, to suddenly connect those dots again, to find out, oh, that's why my grandma did the things that she did. Now it makes sense. Or why this was a big deal in my house that I had never understood about. I hope it helps connect the dots for these people, and then they can understand themselves and their families better.
Mm. I love that. And I mean, I 100% hope that you're right and that more and more people from Latinx communities step forward and say, look, this is the magic that I know. And I would like to, you know, I don't know, but necessarily saying like, oh, I want to share it with everybody or anything like that. Because I know for some people that might not happen. But to be, you know, able to claim it and honor it. And then also, you know, talk about it. I think that's really, really powerful. And I love your point about looking at your own family's sort of practices and histories. It's that problem of people say, oh, well, I just, you know, I wish I had some magic in my life, and they don't realize, you know, what grandma's doing is magic. You can't call it that, or she'll slap you.
So. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. I have to ask you, do you have any particular favorite spells that are sort of your go-to, the thing that, you know, that you just go to first, that are your immediate, you know, default spells?
As in like from the book or just in life in general?
Either way, I'm curious to know.
I work a lot of novena candle magic. That's a big part of what I do, and it's a big part of what I offer as spell service. Just because I find that it works. It's very simple. And I like that it connects me with Holy Spirit, such as saints or, you know, Mary or God or things like that. So I do reach for those a lot. And I do also have a deep love of sort of cleansing and uncrossing work, you know, hex breaking, things like that, because it requires such an intense connection with the divine, which is something that I'm always fascinated by. You know, what happens if we, you know, bring down God around us? You know, what is that power like? How does that feel in our bodies? And then how does that change things when you then transfer that to somebody else? Because a lot of this work, when it comes, at least from my perspective, when it comes to cleansing and uncrossing work, is I'm not doing anything. What I'm doing is I'm placing you in the hands of God. And from there, whatever needs to happen will happen. And very powerful results come out of that. But it's also a little bit, we were talking yesterday about Pennsylvania Dutch folk magic and this idea of when someone comes to them needing a healing or something broken, that they don't say, great, we're going to break that. It says, we will try for it. We will try to do it. Because sometimes it's not meant to be broken. Maybe there's a lesson there that the person needs to be learning. There's a purpose for it. And I like kind of maintaining space for that idea, that maybe it's possible that for some reason this is necessary. And by breaking it, I would be interfering with either your personal growth or some other, you know, greater force that needs this to happen. So those are kind of the two things that I really kind of reach for in this work is, you know, candle magic, especially novena candle magic, very close to my heart, as well as this cleansing and crossing work is something that's very dear to me as well.
Mm-hmm. I love those. Those are some of my favorites as well, or at least the novena work is it's very, very satisfying, I think. And I like the simplicity of it too. Mm-hmm. So you've written this excellent book, which I do hope people are going to go out and check out. It's really a wonderful introduction to these practices. When you were writing this, obviously you're bringing in other points of view. So you get multiple points of view in the book. I think that's really valuable. But you also have launched another project. You're the co-host of the Invoking Witchcraft podcast. So can you tell me a little bit about how you got involved with that, how that got started for you? You know, what are your goals with that show? And kind of where's it going to go?
Oh, that is a great question. We don't know where it's going to go, but we're excited to find out. So I had been interacting with a lovely person on Instagram. Their name is Britton Boyd. Shout out to Britton. They are at Archaic Honey on Instagram. And we had been interacting for a while. We knew we were pretty much on the same page. We have a very similar style of working. We both like to get our hands dirty. We like the nitty gritty. You know, neither one of us are afraid to peel some roadkill up off of the side of the road to, you know, work some magic. And so she sent me this message one day and was like, "Hi, I have a business proposal for you. What is your email address?" And I'm like, intrigued. What could this be? And so they sent me this email, and I go and I look for, I just glance at it for about 2 seconds, read the first line that she's saying that she wants to start a podcast with me. And I'm like, yes. I was so excited because I knew that she would be perfect as, you know, a co-host. We both see very eye to eye on these things. And she has a very deep understanding of the work that I think is necessary to have before we talk about it. You know, so many people are like, "Oh, I started doing witchcraft last week. I'm going to start a podcast and teach people how to do it." But they don't know the mechanics, what's happening underneath, how this practice works on a deeper level. And that's something that we're really hoping to bring to people. We're here to kind of be the antithesis of what is social media witchcraft, which is just kind of like, you know, put some glitter in some water with some red food coloring and it's a love potion. And we're like, no, we like to actually, you know, get in there and remind people that there are traditions that are important. And that's the reason why they've been around for so long is because they work. They're very fundamental to this work. We are trying to combat ideas like there are no rules in witchcraft, or witchcraft takes no effort, or the only thing that it takes to be a witch is to say that you are one. These are all very dangerous sort of slogans that have been perpetuated in order to make money recently. And then it sort of devolves into the dumpster fire that is witch talk. And we wonder how they got there. Well, it was because we kept saying these things. And so we're hoping to sort of try and reverse that a little bit by bringing people back to, you know, the fact that this stuff requires work, requires effort. Sometimes you have to get your hands dirty. Sometimes you have to sacrifice or be uncomfortable. And hopefully people are willing to listen. So far it's going well though.
I've loved the episodes I've heard so far, and I do love this. I mean, you even end each episode kind of emphasizing this idea of go and do the work, right? It's not quite your sign off. What's the sign off that you do?
It's do witchcraft.
Do witchcraft. That's it. Yes. But yeah, it's this idea of the do is the important part there, right? You have to go and do it. And I love kind of the direction you're going with it. You're also focusing on a lot of different types of folk magic. I think you just put out an episode on doing petition papers and charm papers and shoes is one of the things that you're talking about. Is that right?
Yeah, it's all about shoe magic. So it's about putting things in your shoes, putting shoes in places, all kinds of stuff, anything that involves shoes.
Yeah, which is wonderful. I love that kind of like micro focus on sort of specific aspects of witchcraft. It's something that I'm seeing more and more people doing. Not that there's a glut of people doing it, but there's a few really good people doing it. And both of you are doing it. There's a woman named Via Hedera who's doing a really, really good job with similar stuff. And I'm loving to see people interested in folk magic and interested in doing, going out and doing the work, even if it's a little uncomfortable. And one thing I think that you both address in the podcast is this idea of that comfort level, that witchcraft doesn't happen in a comfortable space usually. It's not that it should always make you feel absolutely horrible, but that being uncomfortable, being a little bit afraid can be actually a very powerful part of the witchcraft. Is that something that you sort of found in your practice as well?
Absolutely. I feel that when we do this work, not only does the uncomfortability help us grow, but that uncomfortability, that fear, is also a gatekeeper to higher levels. And so when we're faced with that fear, we're given the choice to either back down from it or push through and then learn even more. So we have to realize that when we do witchcraft, that fear might be a part of it. And being able to kind of master that fear and work forward and kind of still go strangely into the woods, you know, is still a big part of it. And the uncomfortability, the willingness to sacrifice and put in the work shows these higher forces that we are worthy of receiving these things. A lot of modern witchcraft is like, well, I don't want to put any work into it. I don't want to give anything up at all. I just want these things brought to me. And that's great. But also sometimes you do have to put in work. Sometimes you do have to show that you are worthy of getting this big thing that you've been asking for. Otherwise, you're just sitting there on the sofa expecting, you know, a spirit to come and deliver you things. And this is not Amazon. This is witchcraft. You know, you might have to go out and actually, you know, do something in order to make it happen. And I think that's something that we're losing in modern witchcraft. And I like to bring back the idea of working for what it is that you want.
Mm-hmm. I am curious, you know, we mentioned this earlier, this idea of people kind of embracing, you know, hashtag Bruja, right? And again, there's some tongue-in-cheek aspects of that. But why do you think there has been such a surge in the popularity of witchcraft? And do you feel like, you know, obviously there's some negatives that can come out of that, but what are some of the positives that you're hoping to see kind of come out of that?
I like that there's a lot less stigma around it, which is really nice, especially given the fact that this is what I do for a job. So when I'm at like a dinner party and people are like, so what do you do? It's like, what do I do? So it's a little nice that now people sort of have an understanding of it. Or when I say this is something that I do, they're like, oh, like my sister does that. Or there's a little, it's a little more comfortable to talk about in public, which mm-hmm. is nice. I do like that. And I do like that it's bringing people an alternative to still connect with the divine and still be spiritual in a way that doesn't require them to be indoctrinated into a church. Mm-hmm. So I do think that that's very helpful, especially for our young people, especially right now where we are having such an intense sort of queer liberation movement, which is amazing and it's beautiful. And it's giving these people kind of a safe space to go as far as spirituality is concerned. I do wish that people would separate spirituality and witchcraft from one another a little bit. But I do like sort of those things that this movement is creating as far as acceptance and destigmatizing the work.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. I love that. Okay. So you've done this great book. You've got a great podcast. What else is on the horizon for you? Are you working on any other projects? You know, where do you go next?
I am hoping to come out with a second book. I am a very strange writer in the way that normally when people go to pitch a book to a publisher, they have like the first couple of chapters and they send it to the publisher and the publisher kind of says yay or nay. I write the entire manuscript and I plop it down on their desk and go, do you want it? because me, I know myself, you know, as an Aries person, as soon as there's like a deadline involved, I'm not going to want to work on it at all. So I have to do it as a passion project on my own and then kind of bring it over. So I am just about done with book two, which I will be plopping down on Judica's desk in probably a couple of weeks. And hopefully you'll be seeing that come out, hopefully around this time next year, maybe a little bit later. So that's kind of on the horizon for me. I am going to be putting a lot of work into this new podcast, which is at Voking Witchcraft on Instagram. You can find us basically anywhere that podcasts are found, including Spotify. So if you want to listen to us there, that's great. Going to be putting a lot of work into that, as well as my business. You know, I do spellcasting service for people. I have a small online store where I sell charms and wards and bath mixes, things like that. So it's a lot of just doing the witching is what's on the horizon.
That's good. I love that. Well, you're living up to your own slogan there, sort of doing the witchcraft, and doing a lot of it. It sounds like that's really good.
A lot of it.
That's wonderful. Jay Allen Cross, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time today. Fantastic conversation about your book and about Mexican American and American brujería. Beautiful stuff. And I hope people will go check this out. So thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me. I've had a great time.
Ostiones alvaradenos, los que vengo a realizar a un precio más que barato, así vengo a regalar.
Our immense thanks to Jay Allen Cross for sitting with us and sharing his insight. The book has already been making huge inroads into folk magic since its publication, and it's one I highly recommend on a personal level, and not just because so many of the workings in it resemble the things I grew up with as a folk Catholic. You can find out where to buy the book and how to get in touch with Cross through the links in our show notes. If you have feedback that you'd like to share with us, you can reach us by finding us on our website, www.newworldwitchery.com. You can email us at either of our email addresses, which include compassandkey@gmail.com or newworldwitcherypodcast@gmail.com. Either one of those will reach us. You can find us on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter, on TikTok, and I believe on YouTube and a couple of other places as well. There's a lot of them, and they're all linked in our show notes. If you'd like to help support the show, keep it going and make it even better, you can join us at our Patreon, which is patreon.com/newworldwitchery, where you can donate $1 a month or whatever you can afford and help contribute to the show's growth and development and get a couple of fun perks along the way as well. If you enjoy this show and also are interested in pop culture such as Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you might also want to check out our sister podcast, Myth Taken. You can find that at mythtakenbtvs.com. Again, our special thanks to Jay Allen Cross for being with us tonight and for participating in this interview and letting us know a little bit more about his experience. We will be back with you again very soon. We hope that you enjoyed this episode, but until next time, thanks for listening. Be well.
New World Witchery is a production of New World Witchery Podcasts and is released under a Creative Commons Share and Share Alike license. The title and closing music for this episode is Woman Blues by Paul Avgernos, licensed from AudioSocket.